The President's Press Conference, January 16, 1953.
I've got a couple of short statements here, and for Tony's benefit, I'll try to read them slowly. This is my 324th press conference since I became president. It's also my last press conference before leaving the White House. I want to thank all of you for the courtesies you have shown me, and I want to urge all of you to continue to do your best to dig out the facts and put them before the people. Naturally, not all the newspapers agree with me, and I do not agree with all of them. But in spite of these differences, I want to make it plain that I think it is important for our democratic system of government that every medium of communication between the citizens and their government, particularly the president, be kept open as far as possible. The kind of news conference where reporters can ask any question they can dream up directly to the President of the United States illustrates how strong and how vital our democracy is. There's no other country in the world where the Chief of State submits to such unlimited questioning. I know too from experience that it is not easy to stand up here and try to answer off the cuff all kinds of questions without any advance notice. Perhaps succeeding presidents will be able to figure out improvements and safeguards in the procedure. I hope they will never cut the direct line of communication between themselves and the people. I know you have a great many questions on your mind. For some of the answers, I'll have to ask you to wait until my broadcast tonight, because I've tried to put into that broadcast my feelings about the years I have spent in the White House. Now, that's the end of that statement. Then I have one here that's mimeograph.
Is that one mimeograph?
I don't believe
it's mimeograph.
I don't believe it's ready yet, but it will be mimeograph.
This one is mimeograph.
As I take leave as President and Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces, I would like to express my feelings concerning the job being done by men in uniform to keep our country strong so that peace can be maintained in the world. I do this because from time to time there have been unfair and malicious attacks upon some of the key personnel in the armed forces, as well as upon other government officials. During my service as Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces, my duties have brought me into close association with the military leaders and senior officers of the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force, and the Marines. These men have strongly impressed me with their sincerity, their high sense of duty, and their devotion to their country. Directly upon them rests the heartbreaking responsibility for decisions which mean life or death for the courageous men whom they lead. And directly upon them lies an ever greater responsibility of helping to protect our nation and our ideals. In peace or war, they have the additional responsibility for making efficient use of a vast portion of our national resources. The organization they manage is many times the size of the combined steel, oil, coal, and automobile industries. The personnel and material they handle, the transportation problems they face, the financial business they transact, all in addition to their military duties, are almost beyond comprehension. Because these men accept the disciplines of military service, a few people have found it easy to criticize them, to charge them with extravagance, mismanagement, carelessness, and a host of other offenses, with little fear that they will fight back, no matter how unfair or unjust the charges. Such criticism makes headlines, no doubt, but in my opinion is generally most unfair. I believe that our military leaders are doing a tremendous job and doing it well. To weaken public confidence in them by destructive criticism is reprehensible. I know no group of men more deserving of our respect, gratitude, and support. I can say that from the heart because I've been on both sides of the fence. I investigated the military thoroughly during World War II. I served in the armed forces during World War I, not with any very high command, but I understand what the difficulties in the the things that the men have to go through with who are responsible for the operation of our military, the military part of our government. I'm hoping that this statement will have some effect. I want to say to you before we start questions that I sent another letter. I thought that would get you. To the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee and to the chairman of the Finance Committee of the House and the Senate on the president's salary. I'm hoping these gentlemen will release those letters to you. I don't feel that I should release them at this end, but I thought I'd tell you about them so you could make some inquiry. And I also want to say to you that it might be interesting to you to know that since 1945, when I came up here at the White House, I've taken 1,002 morning walks. Some of you went on one or two, but you didn't go on anymore. I'll try to answer questions now as best I can.
Mr. President, as I understand it, that first statement's not mimeographed, and it was one paragraph that you were moving along rather rapidly there.
Where was that, Tony?
About keeping the channels of communication open, what I was trying to make clear, are you recommending a continuance of the presidential press conference?
I am, yes. That's the gist of this this little document.
What prompts you to put it? Any particular reason why you...
Well, I've been reading speculation in the press that the press conference is going to be discontinued. Now, I just don't want to see it discontinued because I want to find out what's going on. That's the best way to say it.
It's not a very profound question, but have you decided on what kind of hat you're going to wear?
No, Eddie, I don't want to get into any hat controversy. The objective of my turning the presidency over to my successor is to do it as expeditiously and as easily as it can be done, and I'm not going to get into any controversy over what I'm going to wear. I'll wear anything that will conform to decency.
Mr. President, as a result of your 8 years of press conferences, have you any recommendation for changes?
Well, no. The change I think we made when we came over here where everybody could sit down, and where in the beginning when I was not so well acquainted, when the person asking the question would announce his name and the paper he represented, I think that was an improvement over that where we all stood in a crowd and couldn't hear the question.
Now, would you change it?
I'm perfectly satisfied with it. I have just as much fun out of it as you do.
Well, what about written questions? Do you think that would add to...
I don't know. I have never tried it, Pete. It might be give you more chance to deliberate, but then I like this rough and tumble press conference we have right here. If I can't take care of myself, that's my fault. Tony, you've been trying to ask a question.
Well, I would get back to hats. I wondered if your hat be like Abe Lincoln's or Dean Acheson's. Maybe that's a simple way to answer.
Well, I can't answer, Tony.
Do you think the press conferences should be regular, like you held them once a week or twice a week? Or
I think they ought to be with regularity. I think it adds to the information of the public as to what goes on, and I think they're entitled to know what's in the president's mind.
Mr. President, you said that you've made some mistakes or had some embarrassing experiences in press conferences. Granting that, if you will.
Which I don't, Eddie, but go ahead.
I think the advantages all around would outweigh the risks or the embarrassments?
Yes, I think so. I've had all sorts of, in 324 press conferences, I imagine I've had all the experience that a man can possibly have at a press conference, and I've never felt that I would want to discontinue them, and I've never felt that I've been unfairly treated.
Well, Mr. President, is it not true that a president, of course, by his office is somewhat isolated, and that you get from us a look at the outside things, too, in your conferences?
I think that's what I said here at one press conference, that by the questions you ask, I find out a lot of things that you don't think I find out.
Have you reached a decision in the Rosenberg case, sir?
The Rosenberg case has not come up to me, therefore I can't reach a decision in it until it does come up.
Mr. President, last week I think Senator Watkins of Utah or seven in the Senate, that you were considering transferring these Tidelands oil to the Navy.
I have an executive order in the mill now, and I'll turn it loose just as soon as it's ready.
Transferring the...
Tideland, no, it's not Tidelands, it's offshore oil. Let me give you a definition of Tideland.
I didn't say
Tidelands. Tidelands is land from high tide to low tide, and that belongs to the adjoining state. The oil land that's in controversy is the offshore oil lands, Tony.
I didn't use Tideland. I just wanted
somebody
to
did.
The executive order made the transfer.
Yes, it makes the transfer.
To the Navy?
Yes.
How far will that extend? All the continental shelf?
Yes, that's the point where I'm laid claim to the jurisdiction of the United States.
And your veto
that's
message.
The continental shelf.
Including
well,
the
no, that is long before the veto message. I laid claim to the offshore oil lands and fisheries in the shallow water. Oh, back in 1945, if I remember correctly.
Are you making any provisions in your order for the so-called the claims of California and Texas?
I'm making no provision except to turn the offshore oil lands over to the Navy.
For national defense purposes, I assume it will
stay. Of course, that's what it's for. If I had time, I'd give you a dissertation on the necessity for maintaining all the oil reserves we possibly can, but this is not the proper place to do it.
President, the new Democratic leader, Senator Johnson, of the steering committee, have broken with some tradition and precedent on the Hill to put freshman members on major committees and see that each freshman got one important committee.
I think that's right and correct and should be done.
That was a good thing.
I think it is a good thing. I was very lucky when I went to the Senate. I got three major committees. I was put on Appropriations Committee, on the Interstate Commerce Committee, on the Public Buildings and Grounds Committee. I was put on those three committees when I first got there, and not very long after that, I was put on the Military Affairs Committee. So I think it's a good thing to have the membership of the committees fairly distributed. I don't think the senators with seniority should hog all the good places on the good committees.
Mr. President, just for the record on that, should be explained, there were many more committees in those days.
I don't know, Pete, whether there were or not.
There were many more committees, and there was multiple membership on. That's the reason they had the fewer committees so they could be on.
I'm not familiar with the present setup, but I was talking of my own experience.
There were many more Democrats then, I believe, and they had many more places, too.
Yes, that makes sense. But that would make it difficult for a junior senator to get places with so many Democrats. I think there were only 17 Republicans in the Senate when I went there.
Will you be accessible when the return to private life?
I've always been accessible. It's a lot easier to see me than it is to see the assistant secretary at the assistant secretary. Or to see an editor in your paper.
What about the questions?
Wouldn't know if I'd be accessible when I went back to private life.
Mr. President, you said this executive order on Tideland is in the mail. When do you think that will be issued?
Well, as quickly as we can get it ready. I can't give you an exact date.
Won't necessarily be today.
It'll be well, of course. I can't issue it after I leave office. What are you talking about? What is it, Tony?
With the executive order on offshore oil, will you issue a statement explaining
yes,
the reasons
I will.
For it?
Yes, I will.
You've described it in the past as $1 billion steal, I think.
You left off two zeros. It's $100 billion.
Billions.
100 billion. It's 100 billion barrels is estimated to be there.
100 billion barrels.
Yeah.
Could you give us a little preview on how the steel would occur?
No. I'll have to cover that in the statement. I've said all I can say on the subject now.
I didn't quite understand the question a while ago. Did you say that you would turn over to the Navy the oil of the submerged lands?
Yes.
Now, that doesn't apply to any other commercial product that might be in the submerged land.
It affects oil only. I don't think the Navy could use fish very well.
Mr. President,
could you tell us anything further about your plans for the coastal plan?
Well, no, I don't think I'm able to give you any definite program because I really haven't any definite plans. I'll tell you what I'm going to do on Inauguration Day, if that'll help you.
Yes, sir, that would help.
All right. I'm going to go to the inauguration with the President-elect. We're riding the same car, and there are several other people in the car. I don't know just who they are. I think Joe Martin's one. And After the inauguration, I shall go out to Dean Acheson's house in Georgetown and have lunch with the members of my cabinet that are leaving office.